Well, thank you very much, Jane, for that very warm and generous introduction. Rumour has reached me that one alumnus or alumna raised the criticism that 1968 was not history but current affairs. I should say in defence of this that, first of all, that history is a dialogue, it is always a dialogue between the past and the present and the past. And secondly, that recent history is far too important to be left to journalists and social scientists. Okay, so my first question is, what do you think about when 1968 is mentioned? Do you think of that? What do you think of that? And what do you feel? Do you feel angry or do you feel excited? Possibly both, because each can be interpreted in different ways. There's a sort of celebratory story about 1968, a story of liberation, both personal and political, and there's a condemnatory story, which talks about how 1968 led to hedonism and violence, if not indeed to terrorism. Now, Jane was very, as I say, generous about my publications, but this particular project was a collective project. It was a project that was took about 5 years to put together. It involved 14 historians, half of whom came from the UK, half of whom from other European countries. And we undertook interviews with nearly 500 former activists across Europe, belonging to about 100 networks, different groups of activists. And we hammered out the ideas and the texts in 5 annual workshops. And this is a picture of the workshop that we held in Prague in, I think, 2009. And as you can see, we're working extremely hard. By the way, the woman who you can see in the mauve top under the tree is Sheila Rowbottom, feminist, historian, academic, and indeed a former member of St. Hilda's College. Now, I'm just going to say a couple of words about our methodology, because we always have to talk about methodology. It was an oral history project, as I say, because of the interviews. Oral history is slightly controversial. Some people like it, some people hate it. What I want to suggest briefly is that the sort of life history interview that we did allows us, it produces stories of becoming, how people became activists, how they were activists, and how they subsequently thought about activism. It sets up an interplay between the personal and the political, which is important because 68 was all about changing the world, but also changing oneself. And it also sets up a relationship between individual memory and what you might call collective memory, or indeed, another way of putting it, is the dominant narrative, or dominant narratives of 68, which, as I have suggested, are either celebratory or condemnatory. So I'm going to begin by talking about 1968 then, and in particular about what turned people on. And all the slides that you're going to see in this lecture are taken from interviews that we did, not just by myself, but by other members of the team. Now here is a young man called Romain Goupil, who was a Trotskyist. He was active in something called the Lycée Action Committees, having been expelled from his lycée. He's a filmmaker, and he made a wonderful film called Mourir à 30 ans, to die at 30, which was in honour of a friend of his, an activist friend who committed suicide. And his line is this: we were the heirs of eternal revolt. We were the direct heirs of 1917. We built barricades as if we had always built barricades. We all saw ourselves as insurgents. There are sort of shades there of the revolutionary youth of Les Misérables. Slightly different is Ole Vint, a Danish student activist. He founded a group called New Society. And he says that he wasn't interested in all this Marxist stuff, Marxist revolution. He was interested in a consciousness revolution, a cultural revolution. And he cites that wonderful slogan that went up in Paris in 68, be a realist, demand the impossible. And here is Leo Migali, who was an Italian activist, belonged to a group called Lotta Continua, and she says, for me personally, 1968 was freedom. That is to say, the concrete manifestation of the concept of freedom. And she says, I'm not just talking about sexual freedom, although that was an issue. And, and then she says, I had a miniskirt up to here. And apparently when she said this, our interviewer said she said where exactly her miniskirt did come up to. Now, I want to talk about, the next thing I want to talk about, the generational revolt, because people talk about the generation of 1968. So was it a generational revolt, and what inspired people? Now, those who made 68 were born either just before, or during, or just after the Second World War. Their parents had been in the thick of the war, either as heroes, or villains, or bystanders, or as victims. Their relationship with the Second World War was therefore mediated through their parents. But even if they were angry with their parents were still their parents, and so it was much easier for them to be angry at the parental generation rather than with the parents themselves, with whom they had ambivalent relationships. Here's the case of Cadet Wolf, who was a student leader in West Germany, possibly one of the best known. He was at the University of Freiburg. His father had been a judge in Hesse and a member of the Nazi Party. And as you can see, he had rows with his father about his father being a Nazi, and then his father died, and he felt rather badly about it. And this is the kind of complexity of relationship that you get between activists and their parents. Another example is the case of Maren Cell, also West German, although she moved to France in 1968. And she's clear that her parents weren't Nazis. Her father used to build airports for the Third Reich. But she tries to invent stories about how they were in fact resistors or how they had Jewish blood. She actually sort of creates a fantasy of them as being different from what they were. Now, this generation of young people were therefore brought up during the Cold War. They were all, whether from East or West, hostile to capitalism and to imperialism. Whether they were brought up in the bourgeois democracies of Western Europe, which of course were hostile to communism, or whether they were brought up in the communist bloc. Now, in the West, many, not all, but many, a good many of 68 activists were the sons and daughters of communists who either remained within the party after the war or who stopped becoming activists, particularly leaving the party after 1956. In the East, they very often, their parents were very often sort of communist apparatchiks who had fought against Nazism during the war and had this sort of anti-fascist mentality, but they were increasingly part of the communist system. Now, these young people's revolt was therefore against what they call Stalinism, but they still remained communists for sort, but dissident communists, which was why they were heavily into Trotskyism and Maoism. Now, here's the example of a guy called Yves Cohen, whose parents were both communists, both resistors, and indeed his mother had been deported to Auschwitz. She returned because she was deported as a resistor rather than as Jewish, and she managed to survive. He said he hated the Communist Party, not least because they used to send him on summer camps to East Germany. He said he was immediately enthusiastic about the Chinese Cultural Revolution when it came along. And then he says, on the one hand, there was this adolescent revolt against my parents, but there was also a constant homage to them because they were resistors, and of course because his mother had been deported, so he couldn't be too angry with her. Here's the case of a Polish activist. I should say these pictures are taken a lot, there are a few pictures taken from the time, but this is obviously taken a lot later. He says that his mother died very old, and she was a resistor and a communist, and she said to him that her generation, she regarded their generation as the manure of history. And therefore he said that when he went into 68 activism, and the high point of activism, of student revolt in Poland was in March 68, he said it was doing it for her to sort of try to make things better. Now, what defined the generation of 68, and this is really what inspired them, was the explosion of what came to call the Third World in Latin America, Africa and Asia. Movements of national liberation and revolution were launched against European colonialism and against American and Soviet imperialism in Algeria, in Cuba and Latin America, in the China of the Cultural Revolution, and of course in Vietnam. Now, leaders of the generation sometimes visited the hotspots of revolution, of world revolution, in Cuba or China, for example. Others participated in these revolts at a kind of imaginative level, demonstrating solidarity and support for them. In either case, the great mantra was to bring the revolution back home from the Third World to Europe. Now here's the case of a British radical, John Hoyland, who was a member of CND. He was also involved in this magazine called Black Dwarf. And he tells the story about how he goes to Cuba in 1966 when everyone else is watching the World Cup. And he gets this idea of a wonderful demonstration in a stadium where the little children hold up signs saying Vietnam Cemetery of Imperialism, and he tries to bring this home to a similar event which he organises in Trafalgar Square. Here we have the example of Jean-Pierre Le Dantec, who in the summer of 1967, he was a young Maoist. They just founded a little Maoist group in Paris, which had broken away from the Communist Party. They went off to China, basically to receive the blessing of the Chinese Communist Party for what they were doing. And what they liked was that they seemed to be witnessing what they called a sort of mass line of Chinese of communism, which was against the sort of bureaucratic Stalinist sort, which wasn't at all afraid of violence, and which paid tribute to the Paris Commune of 1871. He said that delighted us. There was a spiritual time bomb in Mao Zedong saying that a revolution is not a dinner party. We liked Mao's idea that there had to be trouble. Now, of course, the Vietnam War was for most of these young people the great mobiliser of student activism, both in the West and in the East, with this difference, that in the East, the regimes of the Communist bloc were supposed to were officially anti-fascist, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, and therefore they were, in theory, in favour of the North Vietnamese. But for young people, such as Gabor Revay in Budapest, who was involved in the communist youth, they didn't go far enough. And so Gabor Revay says that, you know, they pushed even harder. We organised Vietnamese Sundays. Tons of university students came out to collect money. We had such a young romantic spirit that we applied voluntarily to go out and fight in Vietnam, which, of course, they didn't actually do. Now, the Third World was the great source of inspiration, but it wasn't the only source of inspiration. And here we have a rather curious case of a Northern Ireland activist, civil rights activist, called Ivan Cooper. Now, you may think, well, what did Northern Ireland have to do with 1968? And interestingly enough, the Northern Ireland activists who we interviewed have only started to put themselves into the narrative of 1968 recently, more or less at the time of the 40th anniversary in 2008. And until then, as this guy said, they were much more inspired by Martin Luther King and Gandhi and the idea of the peaceful non-violent march than by what was happening in Prague or in Paris. So he says at that point they didn't consider themselves as part of the European movement. Now, much later, they do. And my last example for inspiration may come as a bit of a surprise, that in 1968 or just after, Britain had something to export. This is the case of Daniel Defferre, who was a former Maoist and also Michel Foucault's partner. And he tells the story of going to Orly Airport to get Michel Foucault off the plane from London, and on the same flight is Antoinette Fouque, who was a rather scary French feminist, and she said, I am bringing the revolution from England. It was feminism. Now, that's that sort of covers becoming an activist. I want to talk about being an activist in a number of different ways. And the first thing I want to talk about is the moment of discovery and recognition when young people came together and you have a sort of crystallization of the personal and the political. Now, this is the case of Anna Fellini, who was studying architecture in Italy when the military coup by the colonels happened in her home country in 67, and she went back to Greece, and she was among the founders of something called the Revolutionary Communist Party of Greece. So she says that when this happened, she just had to drop everything and go back to Greece. And interestingly, what she says is that you know, she wanted to set up this new, you know, get into the mountains and set up these organizations, which were basically replicas of the resistance organizations that you had in Greece fighting the Nazis and then during the Civil War. Now, one of the things I just want to pause a bit with is what I call the language of revolt, because I'm going to come back to this a bit at the end. Now, this is a case of a young man called Olivier Rollin, who was a young Maoist. He later joined something called the Proletarian Left, which I'll come back to. But this is a very interesting thing that he said. Something, as he says, that's very difficult for us to understand now, is at the time, it was automatic for a young intellectual to be a Marxist. You might at the limit be in the Communist Party, although that was less and less the case, because of course the Communist Party was regarded as a Stalinist. You could be a Trotskyist, a Maoist, a Castroist, but not to be a Marxist would have been very bizarre. Now, having said that, not everyone, not all 68ers were happy with this language of Marxist revolution. And this brings me to the case of Nadia Hungar, who was of Polish Jewish and Russian Jewish origin, brought up in provincial, in a rather dowdy place of outside Paris, feeling fairly ill at ease, doing a sociology degree at the Sorbonne. And she says, as you can see here, that for her society was completely stifling. So she had this kind of vague, diffuse idea of liberty and liberation, which she wasn't quite able to pin down. And therefore she hated going to these Marxist meetings where they talked about what kind of revolution was going to happen. But she met this guy called Guy Ockeghem, who I'll come back to later. He was basically the founder of the French gay rights movement. And she said, you know, once I found him and his friends, I was in a different world. She says they were 50 years ahead of everyone else. It was already an anti-totalitarian vision. Here's the case of André Sénic, again, a young a Frenchman of Polish Jewish origin, who, as you can see, his date of birth, 1938, he actually spent the Second World War in hiding, lest he be deported as a young boy. By 1968, he'd been through the Young Communists. He was a young philosophy teacher at a Paris lycée, and he actually lost his job in 1969 for encouraging his students to revolt. And he says for him, the key moment was a demonstration towards the end of May 1958 when Daniel Cohn-Bendit had left the country and the French authorities wouldn't let him back in, and a demonstration was formed where this wonderful slogan went up, this wonderful shout went up, "We are all German Jews." And he says that for him this was a wonderful moment because he didn't have to be this timid little quiet Jewish boy anymore. He could come out, and therefore for him revolt was paradoxically, he says, not a revolt against German French society, but also, but in a funny kind of way, a way into French society. And because I've been a bit too much on France, here's the case of a young Czech activist. And of course, in the Eastern Bloc, it was much more difficult to protest. You had the secret police, you had the Red Army, not so far away. And therefore, a lot of opposition was cultural, parody was used as a kind of form of subversion and opposition to the system. And this young woman, Vera Jusova, was a member of a wonderful organization, which I just to cite the title, fills me with pleasure. It was called the Holy Cross School of Pure Humor Without Wit. And they met in pubs in Prague, and they did various pranks that she describes here, and they observed total equality. And she says that this kind of prankiness was their form of opposition. Now, until now, I've been talking in a rather upbeat way about how things were going. But what you have to remember is that 68 didn't work. I mean, in the French state nearly collapsed in 68, May 68, and then de Gaulle got a grip, held elections, and banned these radical organizations. Obviously, the Prague Spring came to an end with the Soviet tanks in August 1968. But that's not the end of the story, and I have to take issue with people who talk about May 68 as if May 68 was all there was to it. It went on for a long time, and for some of us who were a bit younger, our 68 was in the 70s. Now here's the case of Dominique Grange. She was a very interesting character. She wasn't a young communist. She wasn't from that milieu. She was actually a sort of trendy left-bank singer. She even did. She was even a sort of hostess on one or two TV shows in the 60s. But when 68 happened, she said she took her, you know, she'd just been married, but she took her toothbrush and her guitar, and she went off, she left home, she went off down to the striking workers at Boulogne-Billancourt and sang songs on the back of a truck. And then when it was all over, she said, well, some people went back to work and to their lives, but I couldn't. She was completely transformed by this contact with the general strike. And she said, socially, I was on the same side as the people who were involved in the class struggle. And I wanted to be involved in it, even against my own class. Her father was actually a Lyon doctor, but when she was born, he was a prisoner of war in Germany, and she felt complete frustration that he'd never done anything during the war, so she was going to compensate. Here's our friend Yves Cohen again, because both Dominique Grange and Yves Cohen went into this organisation called the Proletarian Left, which started after 68 and was supposed to carry on the class war, which was supposed to revive this massive strike that had happened in the factories. Now, he explains his entry into the Proletarian Left through three deaths. First of all, the death of his friend. He had a friend called Gilles Toutain, who was drowned in the Seine near when the students went to defend workers at a car factory outside Paris. There was another brutal incident at another car factory at Sochaux in eastern France, and he says it was those two deaths that really drove him to this more radical position. And he talks about this. There he is on the right hand side of the picture, wearing his black jacket and committing himself to revolution. But just in case you think all these people were kind of that kind of revolutionary, this is not the case. And here is a guy called Michel-Antoine Burnier, who had been a young communist, who had fought against the French presence in the Algerian War. In 68, he was involved in a paper called Action, which was basically just a reportage of everything that was going on. But he got increasingly fed up with what he called the groupuscule, these very tightly knit and rather obsessive Trotskyist, Maoist, etc. And so he got involved in setting up a new newspaper, which was a kind of countercultural paper called Actuel. And he basically says, you know, the real message was that everyone can speak to each other. It's a free democracy. At last, people can have sex. Down with bourgeois morality. We secretly said to ourselves, this paper will be a machine to kill off the groupuscule, the little political factions. We will get them through the revolution in spirit, sexual liberation, music and happenings, and we got them. So there was a kind of tension between the kind of youth revolt, there was a wonderful movement in which Cohn Bendit was involved called the 22nd of March movement, which started off at Nanterre, which was much more libertarian, subversive, anarchic, and this kind of development was more related to that than to the hardline Marxists. Now another example of what people did after 68 is a kind of retreat from the streets, a retreat from the capitals. People went off to the provinces. People decided that the revolution in the community was going to be much more important than revolution in the barricades. That the community, if you like, offered a vehicle for change rather than class war. And Marjorie Mayo, who was an activist at the LSE, says here that revolution is about changes in social relations, about changes in power relations. And this can be done at a community level through supporting squatting actions, for example, or facilitating abortions, or supporting local strikes. It's piecemeal, it's community-based, it's not the sort of barricades. Another example from a young French activist, Carla Prodocibo. She was involved at a very young age with an extraordinary movement that happened in Trieste. And at Trieste, there was a man called Franco Basaglia who basically wanted to turn the lunatic asylum inside out. One of the things that you get post-68, and this, you know, people who know about Foucault will get the connection, there was an idea that they must start dismantling these repressive 19th, early 20th century institutions, the prisons, the mental asylums, turn them inside out. Revisit, you know, what is the difference between a mad person and a sane person? And so at this asylum, they basically, you know, took down the bars, people came in, people went out. And this was an extraordinary subversive experiment, echoes of which you have in Britain with people like R.D. Lang and so on. Now, obviously, post-68, you also get the feminist movement. I mean, everyone knows that. In a sense, these people who went to these Marxist meetings, a lot of the women said, "Well, we weren't allowed to talk." It was dominated by these young men who just monopolised all the time. And although there was a lot of talk about sexual liberation, they said, "Well, sexual liberation was okay for them, but it just meant that we were supposed to be easy targets for them." And so the feminist movement developed, but here is a woman, a Danish woman, Brigitte Du, who says, "Okay, I was involved in a Maoist movement, but also I was increasingly less interested in class struggle and more interested in feminist consciousness." And then, of course, within the feminist movement, you have the whole issue about whether it was okay to be a heterosexual feminist or whether you had to be a lesbian feminist. And here she lets the cat out of the bag. She says, "What year was it? Maybe 72, 73, because for the first time I fell in love with a woman." Not only do you get feminism, you also get gay rights. And here we have our friend, now deceased, called Jean Lhabitou. And he was, when 68 happened, he was a kind of repressed student at the University of Nice. His father was a very distant naval officer who he hardly knew and with whom he didn't get on at all. But I mentioned Guy Hockengen. He brings out a special issue of a newspaper called Tout. What did you want? Tout. Everything. They wanted everything. And this issue was dedicated to the issue of gay rights. Lhabitou saw it on a newspaper stand in Nice, and he said, "I discovered an incredible thing, a convergence of my revolutionary convictions and my secret. That is, the emergence or revolt of something as intimate as your sexual preferences, which are not those of others. I discovered militant friendship. Until then, I had not had sex. I did not even know how to masturbate. I think that I only just avoided psychiatric hospital or suicide. I began to piece together the bits of my political convictions and the story of my body." So this is the political and the personal big time, and he becomes a gay rights activist. But just in case, I don't want you to go away thinking that you were either a kind of Marxist or a feminist or a gay rights activist. There was also men's groups. There were also men's groups, and here is particularly in places like Denmark and Britain. And here's the case of Paul Atkinson, who says, you know, that what inspired men about the feminist movement is that they were allowed to get in touch with their emotions. And so this was one of the interesting developments that you get out of 1968. And of course, he actually had a baby with, he had a baby with Sheila Rowbottom, who we saw earlier. Now, I want to talk a bit about, so there's no clock in this room, so I keep looking at my watch. I want to talk a bit about transnational encounters, because one of the things that we were trying to do on this project was to ask the question, was 68 a European movement? And in order to do this, we try to apply some of the trendy transnational approaches that are all around there. And therefore, what you have to do is to see how people encountered each other, what were the ways in which people encountered each other, and more importantly, how did those encounters transform people? I mean, either they gone with each other, either they converted each other, or they didn't convert each other. Either is possible. I want to talk a bit about how people could get in touch with each other. And the first, which I mentioned already, is the summer camp. Europe was full of summer camps, and Jean-Pierre Duteuil, who was a young student at Nanterre, goes off to a summer camp in Switzerland, which was full of Spanish Republicans, in exile from the Franco regime, or from deserters from the Algerian War. And he meets somebody called Gabby Cohn-Bendit. Did you know that Cohn-Bendit had an older brother? And Gabby says to him, my young brother's coming to the University of Nanterre in the autumn. Do you mind looking after him? And everyone's heard of Gabby of Cohn-Bendit. Not many people have heard of Jean-Pierre Dutheil. Another way of people mixing up with each other was through exile. Particularly, for example, if you were in Greece, if you were a Greek radical, after the colonels took power, you basically had to flee. So you went to Italy, you went to France, you went to West Germany. And this is a guy who goes into a bookshop in Bologna. He says, I can't believe the number of pamphlets with hammers and sickles on him. He said, where am I? Am I in heaven? Marin Zell, as I said, she goes to Paris in the autumn of 68, and she studies at the University of Vincennes, which was a kind of laboratory of radicalism. What she says here is that she got into trouble with the dress code, because in Germany, being a German, she wanted to wear makeup and wear low cut dresses, but that didn't go down with the French sort of Marxist activist or Maoist activist, which she was. On the other hand, she wasn't a feminist, so she did wear a bra. So she gets kind of, you know, the transnational fashion criteria rather confuses her. There's also what you might call revolutionary tourism, people turning up in Paris or Prague just to see what's going on. And our friend John Hoyland of Black Dwarf, he actually looks after Rudi Deutschke when he came to England after he was when he suffered an assassination attempt. And he talks about how Paris was a magnet because, you know, he says in Paris, you know, a revolution was going on. Paris demonstrated with all these people on the streets that a revolution was possible. Crikey, it's really happening, he says. So Paris was one great centre, but also so was Prague. Lots of people were turning up in Prague. And here's the case of Sibylle Ploegstedt. She was a West German student who was doing research in Prague. She met up with a Czech activist called Peter Uhle, who himself had spent a lot of time in Paris with young Trotskyists. And here she is. I'm afraid this isn't actually an interview. It's based on a memoir that she wrote, but it's so powerful. I mean, she has this take on, you know, everyone knows about Stalinism's view of socialism in one country. She says, when I got together with Peter Uhle, it was socialism in one bed. Having said that, there were serious misunderstandings between revolutionaries from East and West. And basically, the Western European activists had a kind of revolutionary snobbery. They felt that they themselves in the West were committed to the idea of Marxist revolution, and they couldn't understand why East European revolutionaries, who were, as it were, under communism, didn't share the same ideas. And so Kadi Wolf, who meets up with a lot of Czech activists when they all meet up in a sort of pop festival in Sofia, he says, you know, they just didn't get the idea of a Marxist revolution. They said things like freedom of the press, Dubček is our guy. Boring, you know. But you know, if you want the opposite story, here is a young Polish activist called Blumstein, who has a different view. He says, well, you know, we were living under a communist regime. What we want with communist revolution. So he says, and this is one of my favorite quotes of all the interviews, he says, we were fighting for what they were rejecting. That was all quite obvious. For us, democracy was a dream, but for them, it was a prison. But interestingly, he says he still felt a kind of generational solidarity with these people. It's just that he didn't really understand what they were doing. Having said that, there was a kind of rapprochement that went on in the later 1970s. Because these West European activists who had been in favour of third world revolutionaries started to realise that the Third World Revolutions weren't leading to liberation. They were leading to other sort of dictators like Pol Pot. And for them, one of the most one of the seminal moments was the boat people who started to flee Vietnam after the North Vietnamese took Saigon, and then they started to worry whether they'd been agitating for the right cause. And just as they were getting disillusioned with the Third World, they were getting interested, more interested, in the Second World, in Eastern Europe. And some of them started to take an interest in East European dissidents and how they were struggling against totalitarianism. And here's the example of a Frenchman called Jean-Yves Potel, who had been a hardline French Trotskyist, but he attended the trial of Vaclav Havel and Peter Uhle, another signatories of Charter 77 in Paris, in Prague in 1979. And he talks about, he then later goes and gets involved in the Gdansk strike of 1980 and in the beginnings of Solidarity. And he says, this was a complete transformation for me. I put away my Marxism. I started to meet people who were much more open and even some Christians. And he said, this, you know, I put away my Marxism and discovered the sort of dissidence and sort of human rights activism. Okay, so in the last part of my lecture, I'm going to talk about 1968 now, and I'm going to do this in two ways. The first way, I'm going to talk about how these activists reflect on the legacy of 68 in their own lives. And then finally, I'm going to come up with a few, I won't say random ideas, but ideas about whether 68 could happen now. Okay, so if you remember, I said at the beginning that people, that these interviewees have to place themselves in reference, in relationship to either the celebratory narrative or the condemnatory narrative. And in fact, many of them, some of them, you know, are obviously on one side or the other. Interestingly, many of them have a sort of ambiguous relationship with, and say, well, they were great things, but they're also things that we did wrong. But I'm going to simplify here by giving you some sort of positives and some negatives. So here's Geoffrey Weeks, who is a British gay rights activist, and he is obviously on the side of the benefits of 1968. I think that the critical achievement of those movements was to develop this sense of agency, of being able to remake your own lives. I don't look back nostalgically to that 68 moment. I actually see it as having opened up possibilities which are still continuing. Now, there's another positive story, which is a story that you very often encounter from Eastern Europe, where basically 68 activists draw a line between 68 and 1989. So the liberation of 68, which failed, led to the liberation of 1989, which succeeded. And here's a case of Gábor Demszky, who became liberal mayor of Budapest in the 1990s. And this is what he does. He says that, you know, 68 was the beginning of an anti-authoritarian period, which introduced new culture, which allowed us to westernize, and was the beginning of the end of the East, of the Eastern Soviet system. Other people are much more downbeat about some of the things that 68 produced. Here's the example of an Italian feminist who says, you know, she got involved in 10 or 15 years of militant feminism, and then realised at the age of 35 that she hadn't had a baby. And, you know, she went into analysis and had to deal with all this much later on. There were some people, and this is, again, an example of another Hungarian who took a different view. This was a guy who was a sort of traditional leftist, a sort of new left activist in 1968. Then, after 89, he sort of got involved in free market liberalism. But then he became sort of appalled by the disastrous consequences of all this global capitalism on Hungarian society, and the way people who had lived in a socialist society, you know, the poor were kind of left on the heap. And so he started to have second thoughts about the wonders of global capitalism, not least because the people at the bottom of Hungarian society were being considered losers, incompetent, lazy bums. And so he had a sort of late conversion back to Marxism. And then there were other activists from 68 who did have regrets and about the way in which 68 did and was complicit with communism, was complicit even with totalitarianism. And this is the case again of Michel Antoine Burnier, he of Actuel magazine, who had always been friends with Bernard Kouchner, who, as you may well know, was involved in Médecins Sans Frontières. Recently, he was French foreign minister. And Burnier wrote his biography recently, and here you have a picture of Kouchner rescuing little Vietnamese people from the China Sea. And Burnier himself says that, you know, basically he was happy with his radical career, apart from getting it wrong over Vietnam. And when it was a question of rescuing the boat people, he was on the boat. Now, in the last few minutes, I just want to talk about whether 1968 could happen today, and if not, why not? And this is purely speculative, and it's more questions than answers. Now, obviously, the world order has changed since the 68 people were around. The Second World War was a long time ago. The resistance narrative that inspired them has become fairly discredited or questioned in countries like France. The main legacy of the war, one could argue, is kind of Western guilt about the Holocaust. The Cold War, under which, in the shadow of which they grew up, has ended. We have the triumph of neoliberalism, of market forces, of global capitalism, growing inequalities between rich and poor, between north and south. There's climate change, there's ecological crisis. As I said earlier, the Third World Revolutions seem to fail. Dictators have been put in place in the Middle East, in Africa and Asia. Some are sponsored by the Americans, some by the Russians, some by Europe. There have been waves of revolts, but one of the problems about these waves of revolts is that they are very often fueled by Islamic radicalism, and so are they a good role model? Having said that, it has been argued, not by me, by others, that there has been a generational revolt. There has been a generational revolt in recent years by young people more or less born after 1979. They are angry about their parents' generation, the baby boomers, among whom were some of the 68ers. These are the parents who have monopolized good jobs, good housing, good pensions, while, as it were, loading the younger generation with debt. So these young people are justifiably angry about global capitalism, growing inequalities, and ecological crisis. And here are some of the things they've been getting up to. Here we have Seattle in 1999, where the anti-globalization movement, Global Justice, started disrupting the World Trade Organization. You've got French inner city riots happening in 2005. You've got student protests against fees in 2010, and you've got in the bottom right a picture from the Occupy Wall Street movements in the autumn of 2011, which had global resonance. Now, arguably, these people, like the 68ers, have tactics of occupying and liberating certain spaces and practicing direct democracy. They are connected by the new technology of the internet. They have their own rhetoric of struggle. It's not too much Marxist. What they have invented is this idea of the 99% against the 1%. So they are attacking what you might call the new financial feudalism that produces debt rather than goods and keeps the masses in bondage. But my questions would be these. You know, is this working? Is this working, and can parallels be drawn between 1968? Now, one question that one could ask is that whether these events in Western Europe and North America are connected with other movements going on in Greece, in Spain, with the Arab Spring, and movements like the Via Campesina movement in Latin America, which was very much about the struggle for land and so on. So are these movements connected, as 68 movements arguably were connected, although I've also said that there were disconnects and misunderstandings? Is it possible to say that there is a common language? Have these protesters got a common language in the way that I come back to Olivier Rolin, who said, you know, we were all Marxists. Not all of them were Marxists. Some of them were anarchists, some of them were libertarians, some of them were all sorts of things. But they had a kind of language. Even that Polish activist Blumstein said, you know, although we disagreed with the Western activists, we actually felt part of the generation. It seems to me that there's a kind of delegitimation of Marxism at the end of the Cold War. There's a hegemony of neoliberalism. There's a story that there's no alternative to global capitalism, and therefore I think it's difficult for these young people to find a common language to critique the system. Another question would be, do they even have the option to protest, given the levels of debt they've been inflicted with, just to study, so that they are indeed arguably the new bondsmen, the new villains of contemporary society. That's villains, not villains. How far do they have the right to protest, given the way in which the media and politicians delegitimate any protest as soon as any property is damaged, let alone people hurt? And finally, do they dream of personal and political liberation in the way that 68ers do? Do they have the headspace to imagine such things? Or has that imagination been taken away from them in a globalised consumer society? And to answer that question, or to make you think about that question, here are two people, our friend Oli Vint, who we saw earlier, and David Graeber, who is arguably one of the leaders of the Occupy movement, who's just written a wonderful book, well, an interesting book called The Democracy Project, from which this quote comes. And that's the end. Thank you very much.